All right, the case of Green versus the Commonwealth. We're ready, whenever you are.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May I please support Wayne McNichols, appearing on behalf of Mr. Green. Your Honor, this case came about, I guess, initially in December 19, 2012, Mr. Green was convicted of indecent liberties with a minor. He was placed on probation. The first relevant probation violation occurred on October 2, 2013. At that hearing, the evidence was presented that alleged that there was a violation in the form of contact with the victim of the underlying charge from December 2012. The allegation was that contact took place on August 5th, 2013, and that contact, in fact, led to an arrest shortly after August 5th, 2013. The violation report for that October hearing included a great deal of detail about that contact to the point of quoting a police report and noting witnesses to the contact within the text of the violation. And also, the violation report also noted that criminal charges had been brought as a result of that contact. At that October hearing, the defendant was found to have violated his probation after the court heard evidence that included the probation officer's report. The court imposed a jail sentence. The defendant remained incarcerated. The defendant was, in fact, continuously incarcerated throughout from August 2013 up until present. While the defendant was serving time for his first violation, he was convicted, I believe, in May of 2014 of the charges that came about on August 5th.
Well, Mr. McNichol, let me interrupt you. We don't have a record of one of these probation hearings, correct?
That's
and there were a number of assertions as to what conditions he violated. And it's not clear, because we don't have a record, what the basis for the revocation was at that time. I know there's an assertion that it was based on the placement of new charges, but that wasn't the only condition that he was alleged to have violated. So why would we assume necessarily that that was the basis for the court's decision to revoke part of a suspended sentence as opposed to some other reason?
The evidence regarding the charges from August 2013, that evidence was submitted in the form of the probation officer's report.
How do we know that? We don't have a record.
Your Honor, you have the order of the court from the October 2013 trial in the record, and actually I don't think the order was entered as an exhibit, but the violation report was entered as an exhibit in the January trial.
Right. At that point, he'd been convicted. In other words, if I understand this record, and correct me if I'm wrong, the October violation alleged, among other things, that he'd been charged with new crimes. He'd also, I think, failed to report or some other, there were some
yes,
other issues as well. The, what was it, the January, I guess,
yes,
report or hearing focused on his conviction for these new charges. And you're asserting that there's a sort of a double jeopardy type violation because he's being punished twice for the same offense. And I guess my first question is, how do we know he was punished twice when we don't know what the basis for the punishment was in the October hearing, since there were other reasons other than the placement of the new charges that were offered?
Your Honor, the conviction order from the October hearing notes that the court considered the evidence of the probation officer.
Well, but that could have been to all the other violations that were alleged as well, couldn't it?
It could have, Your Honor. However, the court in the January hearing, and it was the same judge in both the October hearing and the January hearing, the court in the January hearing did didn't indicate that these were, that the, didn't indicate that there was some reason other than the alleged contact or the alleged new charges that was brought up in October. The court indicated these are different. Again, I'm looking at page 20 of the January 2015 transcript. Judge Long, that constitutes, the paragraph beginning, that constitutes a violation. And these are different levels of violation. This is a number one violation. In the prior one, that wasn't set forth as evidence by the guidelines. So I believe there is a...
Well, I guess my concern is you're asking us to make an assumption that may or may not be actually supported by the record, but we don't have a record.
Yes.
But let's get past all that, because I'm not sure it even matters, because you're alleging what amounts to a double jeopardy violation, and of course we're not talking about a trial here, so double jeopardy doesn't apply. At best, you've got some sort of a due process argument, it seems to me, similar to what we talked about earlier, confrontation. But that presupposes you're being doubly punished. And it seems to me the law is pretty well settled when you're talking about a probation violation. You're talking about one punishment. That's the punishment that was imposed at sentencing. Now, some of it was suspended, and then, as here, some portion of it may be executed, or all of it may be executed at a later date, but it still constitutes a single punishment.
Your Honor, that's the government's position. We would argue that the liberty interest at stake between the with the two violations, but assuming that that first violation was for a alleged contact with the victim or for the new charges, is it fundamentally fair?
You're not answering my question. My question is, how is double jeopardy violated here in any way, shape, or form when you've got a single punishment? We're not talking about another trial after a conviction. We're not talking about another trial after an acquittal, which are the other two protections. So we have to be talking about multiple punishments for the same offense. We've only got one offense and one punishment. Now, it's true that punishment is being sort of trickled out over time, but how does that offend the any clause of the Constitution, whether it's the Due Process Clause or the Double Jeopardy Clause?
Your Honor, if you look at the successive probation violations as hearings to determine whether or not the defendant violated a term or condition of his probation, and that's the way the trial judges look at them. If you look at them that way, then you have one punishment being the revocation of a suspended sentence being imposed in October, and you have another punishment, arguably for the same activity, again being imposed in January.
Well, you say arguably. What's your authority for the fact that it's another punishment? Are you familiar with the case of United States versus DeFrancisco?
Your Honor, is that case essentially holding that, as the court has said, that probation violations are basically continuances of the original sentencing hearing?
Yeah, among other things. I'll quote from it. You can explain to me why this wouldn't apply to this situation, if you would. In DeFrancisco, the United States Supreme Court said, quote, the Double Jeopardy Clause does not provide the defendant with the right to know at any specific moment in time what the exact limit of his punishment will turn out to be. Even though some minimal procedural safeguards attach in a probation setting, quote, there is no double jeopardy protection against revocation of probation and the imposition of imprisonment, close quotes. Why wouldn't that control the outcome here if we would get to the merits of it?
Your Honor, The simple question is, does that say that are those procedural safeguards so minimal that they're going to allow the Commonwealth to, in effect, revoke somebody's probation twice for the same activity? And that issue has not been before the court in this particular situation with the facts similar to what we have in the Green case. We have a couple of cases that
What support can you offer us for why that? I mean, it does seem counterintuitive, but other than that, what cases can you cite for the proposition that's somehow?
As I've said, there aren't any cases on this issue yet. We have the Canty case, which again, I think both the Commonwealth, but Commonwealth had actually sort of factually distinguished in their brief, and we have the Owings Clark case, which again is factually distinguishable because that court specifically noted in the record at one of the hearings that it wasn't going to consider the pending charges. So this particular case, fact situation has not come up in any of the reported cases.
You can't analogize to anything else that would.
You're right.
I mean, the Code of Virginia says that a sentencing judge can revoke for any basically any good cause, any reason deemed appropriate. So, and certainly doesn't restrict the nature of the behavior. It could be a violation of good behavior, but it could be a violation of any other term or condition of probation.
Your Honor, the question we have, and I do not, unfortunately, I don't have authority on this, is whether or not the trial judge can repeatedly revoke for the same activity. We do have the ruling that double jeopardy does not apply, but the question is, can the trial judge revoke more than once for basically the same acts? And the same acts that as I noted in my petition and brief, that if we apply the Blockberger test, which is how as we stated in the earlier case, how we've looked at double jeopardy in the past, if we apply the Blockberger case, it would seem to bar successive prosecutions.
Well, but we're not talking about a successive prosecution. That was my point.
Yes.
I don't see how you get to Blockberger. Because with Blockberger, you lay the statute side by side and do a comparison of the elements. But here we're talking about a single violation of the law that carries a single sentence that was suspended upon certain terms and conditions which were allegedly violated on multiple occasions.
And, Your Honor, actually the terms and conditions were not violated on multiple occasions. They were violated on one occasion on August 5th, 2004 to 2013. We have one set of behaviors and the defendant gets two successive probation violations. And again, we would argue that violates, if not double jeopardy, then fundamental due process by punishing him.
Well, I guess that gets us back to the original question, which is all this is based on the predicate that we have to assume in the absence of a transcript or other written statement of facts that the trial court here use the same basis for revoking him on both occasions.
And Your Honor, while we don't have a record, we do have an order that says that he considered the evidence of the probation officer, and we have the judge's statements in the transcript from January.
Well, I mean, hypothetically, the probation officer in his first reports noted that he violated or alleged to have violated the special condition requiring to have no contact with the victim or their family member and to register as a sex offender, and also noted, I guess, that these new charges had been brought. But theoretically, the court could have not ignored the fact that the new charges were pending and just found them in violation of the other conditions, in which case we wouldn't have any sort of a multiple application of the same. But we don't know. That's my point. We don't know what happened, you know, what the basis for the court's decision was.
And Your Honor, I can only point to the court's somewhat limited statements in the trial transcript in January. They're not.
Well, that's a boiler. It sounds like a boilerplate. It's in both cases, having heard a report of the probation officer and any additional facts bearing on the matter, the court imposes and fill in the blanks and says.
I'm referring to the court's statements in January during the defense motions to strike. There's no indication from the court in the January hearing that he did not consider the contact with the complainant and the underlying charge, or that he didn't consider the underlying charges.
But do we presume that he erred then? Is that what you're suggesting? Is the presumption the other way? We presume the trial judge knew and followed the law, so to the extent that your argument is that it would be improper to do so, we presume the judge didn't do that.
No. Your Honor, I think the court could reasonably infer from the record of the January hearing that had the court found the defendant in violation of his probation for some reason other than the underlying charges, that the court might have brought that up in justifying his role. He's not required to, but he...
I appreciate you answering my question. I apologize for chewing up all your rebuttal time there. Maybe the Chief Judge will have mercy on me.
Ms. Darren?
Try not to get so excitable this time. Another probation violation.
That was the best part of that last argument.
Case, I think I was coming over the podium. I'll try not to do that. Leah Darren for the Commonwealth. Another probation violation. As the court has pointed out, there is no double jeopardy issue in this case. We argued in on brief.
But that argument wasn't brought up.
The claim in the trial court was that he was being punished twice for the same acts in successive probation violation hearings. As the court has noted, and we noted on brief, there's no transcript of the October 2013 probation violation.
What's the narrowest and best way to decide this from your standpoint? Is it to say we don't even need to get to any of this because it doesn't apply, or would it be to say there's no record here?
The narrowest and safest ground for this court to rule would be that in the first proceeding there were three conditions for the probation revocation violation. That was a no contact with the family or the victim. He hadn't gotten sex offender treatment as he'd been ordered to do so, and he'd been consuming alcohol. None of those conditions were failure to obey the law, which was the condition of the second probation violation proceeding. And so if you look at this court's decisions in Canty and Clark, construing 19.2306D, the court can know about the fact that basically number one, that the conditions are different and you just stop there. But you could go on and say, construing 19.2306D, Canty and Clark stand for the proposition that the court can know that charges have been brought or whatever. But so long as the court doesn't somehow reject those considerations as a basis for revocation in the first proceeding, then there's no bar to the second. And given the kind of conditions that we have in these two different proceedings, being no contact, no sex offender treatment, no alcohol consumption violations in the first, and then failure to obey the law in the second, there's no way we can have that kind of overlap in this case. So we would say that is the basis that upon which this court should affirm in this case. Any questions?
If you don't want to discuss the reliability of the probation officer,
I would be glad to continue that discussion, maybe over lunch.
Thank you very much, Ms. Darren. Mr. McNichols, if you have something more to add, we'll put a minute on the clock for you.
Your Honor, I don't believe I have anything else to add.
Very well. Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel and then take up the case of Wilson versus the Commonwealth.
Talk to me after my third case.
Nice seeing you. Thank you. Great to meet you.